Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Nate Silas Richardson. Richardson is a musician, producer, recording engineer, and teacher. He's played with many highly acclaimed bands, including John Brown's Body and the Sim Redman Band. He's worked as a producer or engineer with Crow Greenspun, Water Bear, and the Urban Horse Thieves. He released a solo album called Uproot in 1999 and recently collaborated with Malang Jobate, and together they produced a unique West African CD called Badima. Richardson is also the audio producer for the Out of Bounds radio show. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tish.
Now, you describe in your biography that you were brought up in a hippie house in South Boston. Tell us about that.
We got the name hippie house because we weren't Irish Catholic. Well, my parents were clearly hippies.
Uh-huh.
We had rainbow paintings on our staircase. You know, each tongue and groove piece of wood was a different color. And, my parents were art students. And we definitely kind of stood out in our neighborhood in South Boston. I guess the long hair didn't hurt either.
Now, do you remember when you were first introduced to music and that it grabbed your imagination?
I have tons of memories of early music, among them just the records that were constantly playing. My dad was a big blues guitar fan, so tons of Albert King and the like. The Beatles, of course, Jimi Hendrix, of course, and all that stuff. And my mom really liked Baroque and other classical music. She had a lot of harpsichord records, and I can remember running around the house with this one particular Scarlatti piece. I don't know what it was, but I remember the sound of it in my head, and I'm not going to try to sing it for you, but it got me really amped up, and I used to just go bonkers for it.
Oh, that's interesting. So did your parents encourage you in regard to music? Did you show any kind of unique love
for
it?
My dad was a player. He played guitar, and we always had instruments around, and their friends were all musicians and hippies and artists, and they'd just have parties until late at night, and I'd always be falling asleep with them all singing songs and such. And my mom's specialty was wrapping the cigarette cellophane around a comb and making it sound like a kazoo. And
there was always just music around.
Yeah, I mean, my
dad... Got into your pores, I'm sure.
Yeah, my dad was a clock collector, actually. Ever since I was born, he had been collecting clocks, and so he used to go to flea markets every Sunday, and I'd often go with him, and he would usually come home with 10 clocks and an instrument of some sort. And I had a ukulele when I was about 4, and there was a Fender Rhodes in the house and a piano in the house, and his electric guitar and his acoustic guitar, and just was always around. So I just started picking the stuff up.
Now, you did end up going to the Berklee School of Music in Boston. When did you realize you did want to have a career in music?
Well, when I was about a junior in high school, when you have to start applying to college, I just didn't have any other thing in mind. I just, when it got to that point, I remember just thinking, well, it's this or nothing, really. I didn't really have much interest in college in general.
Huh.
My mom insisted. It was just not a question. She was going to see that I went to college, so she was happy with that choice. She'd always supported me in music, and, one of the things that I had going for me was that she always would spend money on instruments for me. In addition to my dad coming home with the old, ukuleles and auto harps and bass guitars and stuff, my mom would take me to the electronic music store and buy me keyboards.
Hmm.
So I had a synthesizer while I was still in elementary school.
Wow.
Actually, a couple.
Did you actually play music when you were in high school and early college? Were you part of bands? And
Were
you doing those
bands,
kinds of...
I was in a band with high school seniors when I was not in high school yet.
Uh-huh.
Particularly because I played keyboard, and probably more particularly because I had a keyboard.
And, that would make you popular indeed.
Yeah, we're talking 1987, so
The
synthesizer was an important part. I mean, the first real band I was ever in mostly strayed away from 80s keyboard styles, but at the time, bands had keyboard players. They thought they needed a keyboard player, so I was actually rehearsing with the drummer's younger brother. We shared the same guitar teacher. Our guitar teacher said, you guys should get together. And, we were just jamming at the house one day, and it was me and this guy, Craig, who played guitar, and his friend, Eric Peterson, that played drums. And Eric couldn't make it one day, so Craig invited his older brother Rick to play, and Rick was the drummer for Joe Stretch and the Rubber Band.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Rick heard me play and said he got right on the phone and called the guitar player for Joe Stretch, and next thing I knew, I was playing in this other band and playing at high school dances and, you know.
Oh, that must have been really exciting.
It was very exciting, and it got me into some interesting things that I wouldn't have otherwise got into until I was a couple of years older.
I'm not even going to ask. But yeah, at the Berklee College, you studied jazz composition.
Mm-hmm.
How did you segue from, I assume you were doing rock and roll.
Yeah, I mean, I was definitely into all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Before.
How did you segue into jazz?
The jazz was kind of the had to do it at Berklee. That was what you studied. There wasn't really a classical school. Rock, while being accepted, I think the reason that rock was kind of embraced at Berklee was more of a marketing thing and a financial decision on the college's part, because kids all love to rock, so let's embrace that and we'll get more enrollees.
Mm.
And that certainly fit my profile. And so I got there, and then, you know, they had a history of rock class and a few workshops or whatever. But for the most part, if you wanted to stay there and be in the in crowd, you had to be a burning jazz player, which I struggled with a lot and never really got there.
You were not interested in jazz?
I was, actually. I mean, I was interested, and it was, I was totally blown away by the stuff that I was exposed to there. But, you know, absorbing it and playing it was a whole other thing. It's really, I mean, it's, if you grow up playing, you know, Eddie Van Halen, and you try to suddenly switch over to John Coltrane, it's a real...
It's a real art, too. I mean, it's just as artistic as classical music.
Oh, it's very intricate. I mean, Charlie Parker's solos are... I mean, there's books about the stuff. It's pretty mind-blowing what the guy developed.
So this didn't enrich you enough for you to want to pursue jazz. I know you talk about how interested you became in, and I want to ask you when, in West African music.
Oh, yes. That was about 1998 or so, 1997. I had a teacher, a bass player, Wesley Worth. I was studying Charles Mingus at Berklee, and I was telling him, you know, how much I love that, and he said, well, Charles Mingus is, you know, the groove king in jazz. He's the grooviest bass player there is. But if you want to hear, like, grooviest of all grooviest, listen to this. And he gave me a cassette of Alhaji Baikonti. It's called Kora Melodies from Gambia.
Mm. And explain to people what the Kora is, because I know you're studying it right now.
Kora is a 21-string West African harp with two courses of strings, 10 on one side, 11 on the other. Strictly diatonic. It's been around for a long, long time. It's the most complex West African instrument of all. It's a very ancient tradition. The players pass on to their sons, primarily. That's starting to change now, I think, but it was a male-dominated culture for a long time. When you were born into that family, there was no question which is he going to be, a farmer or is he... It was a strictly caste-based and family-based profession. So when you're growing up, it's not about whether or not you're going to be a farmer or a musician. It's which instrument is this kid going to play, you know?
Mm.
It's a very intense musical tradition that has layers upon layers, which I'm still peeling back and finding.
Mm-hmm. You were just introduced to this, and it just took you.
It took me. It took me. The same way reggae took me in about 1990, when I first started to really listen to Bob Marley and all the amazing Jamaican music. It was a total bug. It was a virus that I couldn't shake. And you know, for the first couple of years, I didn't listen to any other. I had that one cassette until I discovered the internet 3 years later, and, you know, or at least free downloads. You know, it was that one cassette and this one other CD that I got called New Ancient Strings, Tumani Jabate and Balake Sissoko, that sustained me on it. I was just so interested in that recording that I just took it apart and listened to it constantly and basically tried to learn it all on guitar. And when I moved to Ithaca in 2001, that was, you know, my working plan was, I'm going to shut myself up in a shack somewhere in the woods and I'm just going to learn how to play Kora music on the guitar, and that's really all I cared about at that point.
An obsession.
Yeah, I was very obsessed with it. Still am.
Yeah, I actually know you are. I've talked to you about this before. Now, you released a solo album called Uproot in 1999, mm-hmm. and that has a real reggae flavor mm-hmm. to it. Tell us how this happened, and then we're going to play a little cut from it.
Sure, sure. Well, of course, you know, once I heard Bob Marley around 1989, 1990, I got really obsessed with his music, and there was actually a band close by my house where I was living south of Boston that was playing bars, doing primarily Bob Marley covers and Calypso and Soca standards. Mm-hmm. And they were making a killing. Everyone wanted to see them play. It was like the best party vibe ever. You know, it was it was a really successful band. And once again, I had put down the keyboard. I've put down the keyboard so many times in my life. You know, I've given away keyboards that I don't think I'll ever need again, you know.
Really?
And then a year later, the door knocks and it's somebody, oh, I need a keyboard player. So I'm still in that scenario right now with Sim Redman Band. I didn't really plan on keeping up with the keyboard, but this band that I love and wanted me to play in it needed a keyboard player. So anyway, so I got into this reggae band and started to learn more in depth about it rather than it being all Bob Marley, which it's undeniable. He's, you know, the king of reggae, but it's so easy to overlook the 98% of the music that's came out of Jamaica is not by Bob Marley, and you know, most of it is worth listening to.
Now, how did you come about recording a whole album of this stuff? And you even wrote most of the songs.
Yep, I wrote all the music on that CD. Mm-hmm. I co-wrote one song. In other words, I basically took a chorus from a song that Kevin Kinsella had written, which wasn't finished at the time, and I basically finished it, and then he ended up finishing it, and we recorded two versions of it, one being on a John Brown's Body album and the other one being on my CD. But I just got into it because, actually, it was funny, because when I was probably in the days of Joe Stretch and the Rubber Band, I was out drinking with one of my friends, and we were, like, lying on the ground looking up at the sky, and he said, someday I'm going to be rich, and I'm going to finance your first album.
Is that what happened?
And, yeah, in 1997 or so, he called me up and said, I'm rich. I'm ready to start your album, you know, and he just basically wrote me a check, him and a partner of his. Basically financed the album. So I got to do it right. I got to do it on tape in real studio. You know, I got to pay them. Every musician that was involved was paid, I hope. If I didn't pay you, call me up.
Well, I want to play an excerpt from this. It's called Don't See Me. And this is from Nate Silas Richardson's Uproot. You wrote that when you were in your mid-20s, correct? It's very autobiographical.
Yeah, that was, I just, you know, I was pretty new to songwriting at the time, and I still kind of am. I never really did much songwriting after that CD. I've tried over the years, but it's definitely not my forte.
That was your magic moment for Uproot.
Yeah, when somebody throws money at you, you just do it. So I just wrote a whole bunch of songs. I had a few in the can at the time, but I think that was one that I had already written. But I wrote that because there was some interaction. I don't really remember who it was or where it was, but I remember the feeling I had was that I was being judged on my appearance.
Mm.
You know, I had dreadlocks down to somewhere around
here. Oh, really?
Just somebody that I could tell didn't really want to know anything about me, and I felt the sense that they would have if I didn't look the way I looked, you know? And I wasn't a slob or anything, but, you know, she passed me by just because of appearance on the surface, and that song came out of that experience.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Nate Silas Richardson. He's a musician and producer and sound engineer. Now tell us, what is it about reggae that you love so much? Is it the beat of it?
Or? Well, it's exotic. I mean, to my ears at the time when I discovered it, it was very exotic. It was everything was reversed from what I was used to. On rock music, you get bass drum, snare drum, bass drum, snare drum. And in reggae music, you get a big rest and then the bass drum. And then a big rest and then the bass drum. And the snare drum is only used as an accent every so often. And to me, that was brilliant. Because it was so strange and different for me, and just the music is so powerful, especially the Bob Marley stuff. I mean, he's singing revolutionary lyrics and really challenging, speaking truth to power. You know, that's powerful for somebody that's 18, 20, you know. You're trying to find what's right in the world, and you're seeing all this evil going on around you. And, you know, to me, it just made a lot of sense. And
it seems very optimistic most of the time.
Yeah.
And universal in some ways.
Yeah, I think that's a generalization that definitely holds true for a lot of Bob's songs. It's definitely deeper than all that, too.
Oh, absolutely, you know? It has taken me, too. I absolutely love reggae music. Yeah. Now, how did you get into sound engineering? How did you segue from music
to
sound?
I was, along with keyboards, my mom, and we weren't rich by any means. My mom made it a priority to have musical instruments in the house, and one of the other things she did was, I think I was 14, I was at summer camp, and I can remember calling in to see when the Porta Studio was coming in, and you know, they advanced ordered this 4-track cassette machine that that when we were in buying our keyboard, the guy could tell that my mom was really into keeping her son in the know when it came to you know music technology. And so, you know, we wanted to have this 4-track machine, so I had that growing up. And then I used that thing up. Every band I was ever in, even just friends' bands, I made demos and recordings, and came up with some really excellent stuff throughout the years, I must say. The limitations of the 4-track are not as much of a big deal as you might think. You can do a lot. I mean, Sgt. Pepper's, I think, might have even been made on a 3-track. So, So I graduated from that into reel-to-reel 8-tracks and, you know, then ADATs. Over the years, you know, probably we're talking a 20-year time span now. 2001, I moved to Ithaca, and, you know, the rent on that little shack in the woods was due. So I called my friend Sim, because I knew he worked here at Rep, and said, you know, what are the chances I could come in and start working? I had been working with John Brown's Body on several albums at that point. We had done, I think, 2 or 3, and we did Spirits All Around Us up at Wilburland, and I remember being incredibly inspired by working with Matt Sacucci Murano, who was so on top of things. And I had done Uproot, and we did This Day over at Pyramid, and I had been up here at Rep recording a little bit with Sim. And I just remember thinking Matt had it so together in terms of just really keeping the flow, the creative flow. The band was always, you know, he was always ready to hit record. There was never any waiting around, which was unique in my experience up until that point. And I just saw myself as somebody who could do that and needed a job, I guess.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I got into it, and I've just loved it. It's been very natural for me to
I think a lot of people think engineering just means you're pushing buttons, but really there's a much more to it. You're
every engineer is a producer.
You inspire people, and
every engineer is a producer. I think that you get producer credit when you get paid extra to be the producer. Uh-huh. But really, if you ever see Engineered By, you can pretty much count on the fact that they were guiding musical decisions and helping the band assess what was a good take. And especially now when editing is so in-depth and the amount of editing that happens, I'm not saying the Doobie Brothers didn't spend 30 hours editing one song, but you know, now you can what you can accomplish in 30 hours is tremendous, and so the editing, the engineering becomes a really important factor in making a record.
Now, for a number of years, you toured both with John Brown's Body, and you were part of the band, also with Sim Redmond. What is that like? Do you like being in the background?
I've definitely felt that suits me much better than trying to front a band. I fronted a band for years from the early 90s. I started fronting a band, and
what was the band?
Silas Shepherd Trio was the was the band that I first started out as being the guy up front.
The front guy, But why do you not like to front?
Well, I don't mind it so much, but I find that, A, my songwriting isn't super strong or prolific. I mean, I think I have okay songs, but I couldn't sustain a band. I couldn't write enough material to keep it interesting for people to keep coming back. And the whole game is make people want to come every single time that you play. You know, mm-hmm. that's the way that you can make a living as a musician. So yeah, I found that, you know, being in John Brown's body, I was able to shine in a supporting role. And I feel that my personality is that way too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a peacemaker by nature, I think, you know. But being in Sim Redman Band has been it's like a homecoming. I feel like, you know, John Brown's body was 9 or 10 guys on the road all the time, stuffed in a little van. We had a lot of personalities and a lot of different, you know, my role as peacemaker was very...
in need.
It was very in need, I guess you could say. And, like, I get in the van with Sim Redman Band, and it's like a party. I'm so psyched to just be there, and everyone's just... There's not as much, you know, tension in terms of personalities, and we're all just kind of on the same page that way, and it's just been really enjoyable.
As a trained musician, do you feel as somebody in a supporting role, do you have creative freedom at all, or do you just play your part? They tell you what
Certainly.
You're supposed to be doing.
No, I mm-hmm. very much feel that. In fact, I feel like kind of was the default musical director when it comes to should we do it this way or that way, or, you know, what should the feel be, or, you know, and it's not always that nobody has ideas. Of course, everyone's got ideas, but I don't know. I think because I've been on the road and just, I think I've always been somebody that the other guys look to as one with experience.
Mm-hmm.
And, usually I feel like I have a lot of kind of control over, you know, which way we go with the music.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we run out of time, I want to talk about your current work called Badima.
Mm-hmm.
To tell us about your collaboration. Tell us about the CD.
Yeah, Badima, it started in February of 06. I ran into Malang at a house dinner engagement, I guess you could say. It was basically he was staying with friends in Boulder. I was on the road with John Brown's body. We were passing through. My friends knew I was fascinated with the kora, and so they said, you know, you all have to come together and have dinner at our house and bring your instruments and play. So we did, and it was an instant click.
To tell us a little bit about him, though. He's a very famous kora player, is he not?
Well, famous, he should be famous.
Or well-known.
He's not necessarily well-known. He's well-known in West African circles,
mm-hmm.
And hopefully that will expand into just the entire American culture and worldwide culture. Malang's playing is top-notch. He needs to be more recognized. So anyway, we got together that night, and the very next night we were playing in Denver, and I called him. I think he said he wanted to come to Denver, and he got on a bus. We were leaving early in the morning for whatever reason. We had an early sound check, and he got on the bus, rode to Denver, and came to visit me just to play some more. We only had about a half an hour to play, but I don't think he ever had heard an American guitar player that had any knowledge of West African music at all, let alone the amount that I did. And at that time, I had already been studying with Mamadou Diabaté and Moussa Sissoko, and you know, really gotten deeply into it. It was like the first thing I played for him. He didn't play until he heard me play that first night, and I played a little piece of Sunjata, this classic epic piece, and he just kind of perked up. He couldn't believe that, whoa, this white guy can play our music, you know.
And so the collaboration happened. I want to play an excerpt from Badima. It's
okay.
It's called Kolda, so let's listen to it.
Jarama, 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 Jarama,
About? Well, Kolda, this is a song, Jarama is the refrain, and it means thank you in Fulani. And what is it about? It's about appreciation for the region of Senegal called Kolda. It's about the people living in peace together. It's about different tribes coming together and, you know, working out their differences. And it's a song of appreciation for all the peaceful people of that region.
Mm-hmm. And tell us a little bit more about the album, though. It's gotten quite a few cuts on it, 12 or so?
Yeah, something like that. After we met in Colorado, it was, you know, only a few months later, I had invited him that night. I invited him because I was involved with Crossing Borders, this local music, world music series that Denise Karamardian put together. And I remember the first time I saw that was with Hank Roberts and Yair Dalal in the Cornell Middle Eastern Ensemble, and it was... To me, it was another moment of this is right for me. You know, I knew that I wanted to do something like that where I brought West African musicians into Ithaca. So when I met Malang, I said, you got to come play Crossing Borders. I bought him a plane ticket and booked a few other gigs so that I could guarantee that I could at least pay myself back for the plane ticket. And it was, you know, a 10-day stay. And at the end of that week, we were in here recording all week and various gigs. He was getting on the plane in Syracuse, and we stopped by my friend Jocko's house up in Syracuse to do one last recording session the day before the plane left in the morning. And we got in the car to go to the airport, and his cousin Jolly, who he met here off chance, they didn't know that they were going to see each other, but they ran into each other here, said, you know, Nate, you have to convince Malang that he needs to stay in Ithaca. You have to convince him. Don't let him go. Don't let him go. And we were just still riding to the airport. We got to the airport, got out of the car, and Malang said, I'm not going on the plane. I'm going to stay here. So then, you know, we had all these recordings that we had started during that week, and we just took a year and a half to finish them up. I just basically overdubbed on them. Most of the recordings that you hear, the Kora parts, were recorded that first week he was here, and I just put on top of them.
It's really a remarkable CD, I think.
Well, thanks, Tish.
We're almost out of time. Is there anything else you're working on creatively?
Well, oh yeah, sure. There's a lot. The Thousands of One CD we're mixing right now, and that's going to be tremendous. That's going to be out in March, I think. Sim Redman Band's going into the studio next weekend or the weekend after that to start tracking their new CD. Malang has been starting to record a solo Kora CD here, which has been really fun. No overdubs, no...
Are you going to produce?
Fancy stuff, of course. Yeah, I'm going to be here recording it, and there's not going to be much production to do. It's just going to be recordings of him playing by himself. So
a lot on the horizon.
Yeah.
Well, Nate Silas Richardson, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.